Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Board of Education of New York against Harris, the Secretary. Bruno, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Joseph Bruno. I'm Assistant Corporation Counsel with the City of New York. I represent the Petitioner Board of Education of the City School District of the City of New York. This case presents to this Court the issue of the proper test of discrimination under a federal grant statute known as the Emergency School Aid Act, as well as the proper test of discrimination under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, as well as the interrelationship between ESA and Title VI. It is the position of HEW and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that the test of discrimination under both ESA and Title VI is a disparate impact test. The Board's position is that under ESA and Title VI, the test of discrimination is a constitutional intent test. A bit about the facts. The ESA statute sets up a competition in this country among school districts which seek to apply for a limited pool of ESA funds, approximately $1.5 billion. Proposals are submitted to HEW for grading on programmatic merit, and a program would be funded if it came within the range of programmatic merit, except if it was found to be ineligible under the provisions of Section 1605(d)(1) of the ESA statute. Suffice it to say that the Board of Education submitted a proposal was found to have sufficient programmatic merit, but was denied funding under Section 1605(d)(1)(b) in that HEW found that certain of the New York City high schools were racially identifiable based upon staff assignments.
Counsel, is 1605(d)(1)(b), so 1605, the statute in question, does that involve the proposal submitted for funds, or does it involve the practice, existing practices of the school board submitting them?
It involves existing practice. It was the basis for finding ineligibility. That is the ineligibility section of the ESA statute. It does not relate to the individual proposals. Proposals are apart from that. This is a basis for finding ineligibility. It talks about current practices or activities. The finding of ineligibility was based essentially on a statistical report done by HEW in relation to a 1976 OCR noncompliance letter. The validity of that determination of ineligibility was a subject of at least two reviews at HEW, was considered by the district court in the Eastern District of New York before Judge Jack B. Weinstein, and appealed to the Second Circuit. Now, the circuit held that ESA itself requires application of an impact test in determining eligibility for funding when the issue is staff assignments. The Court of Appeals also held that Title VI incorporates an impact test, and therefore that the staff assignment policy of the Board also violated Title VI. Let me deal first with the ESA statute. The subdivision I've indicated is Section 1605(d)(1)(b). It states, "No educational agency shall be eligible for assistance under this chapter if it has, after June 23, 1972, had in effect any practice, policy, or procedure which results in the disproportionate demotions or dismissal of instructional or other staff, minority staff, in conjunction with a desegregation plan."
How do you get away from the language "which results"?
Well, we do not, and we concede with respect to demotions and dismissals. The issue in this case is assignment of staff. With respect to demotions and dismissals, we concede that is a disparate impact test for a very clear rationale. With respect to assignment of staff, the statute states, "or otherwise engaged in discrimination based upon race, color, or national origin in the assignment of staff," which is the issue in this case. We concede that demotions and dismissals is a disparate impact test for a very clear rationale, and Congress so stated. I will get to that very shortly. With respect to assignment of staff, however, the language is or otherwise engaged in discrimination. HEW contends that this language of the statute makes it obvious that the test applicable, which we concede is disparate impact to demotions and dismissals, is the same test that should be applicable to assignment of staff. I would note that Congress used very different terms when it dealt with demotions and dismissals as opposed to assignment of staff. I would also note that in this section, 1605, D1, which is the entire ineligibility section, there are five activities that would render a board ineligible. Within this section, it uses discrimination twice. It uses it in subdivision D, which deals with avoidance of minority group participation in curricular or extracurricular activities, so as to discriminate against them. That's the other place it's used. HEW concedes there that that is an intent test. We say that if Congress knew what it was talking about with respect to subdivision D, it certainly knew what it was talking about with respect to subdivision B, dealing with staff assignments. HEW can do nothing with that. I would note that the real issue in this case is what did Congress intend when it used the word discrimination? HCW contends that the legislative history is extremely relevant, yet they totally ignore perhaps the most relevant legislative history in dealing with the meaning of the word discrimination. They say not one word in their brief about Senate Committee Report 92-61, which states in essence that one and only one practice in subdivision 1605-D1B is presumed to be discriminatory if disparate impact exists. That speaks directly to subdivision B. Subdivision B has two types of activities, demotions and dismissals, and for the sake of this argument, assignment of staff, with two very distinct clauses in it. That committee report makes it clear that one and only one is presumed to be discriminatory. HEW ignores the language later on in that same Senate committee report where it states, the phrase disproportionate demotions or dismissals is not modified or in any way diminished by the subsequent phrase, or otherwise engaged in discrimination on the assignment of staff. These are two separate and distinct clauses.
Well, you wouldn't contend, would you, that the rulemaking authority of the agency charged with carrying out the act is necessarily bound to follow the committee reports of one of the houses of Congress?
Oh, no. They're bound to follow the intent of the legislature in enacting a statute. We say the clear intent of the legislature enacting this is to require an intentional discrimination test for assignment of staff. Let me tell you why.
But the reasoning of your last argument, as I understood it, was a reliance on the Senate committee report.
My last argument was a reliance on a Senate committee report to indicate what the intent of the legislature was in passing this particular statute in this particular section. Let me say further, beyond that, there is other ample proof of that what the Congress was talking about when they used the word discrimination.
Well, I don't doubt that it's a factor, but I got the impression that you were saying that the agency charged with making the rules can never go against the language in a committee report.
Absolutely. No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that language in that committee report taken with the legislative history indicates the intentional discrimination test for this section of the ESA statute, which is the eligibility section, which is the issue in this case. In 1972, when the language of the section was enacted, the meaning of the term discrimination, as discussed by Congress, and it was very clear what they were talking about. They were talking about Swan, they were talking about Brown, they were talking about intentional segregation, de jure segregation, when they were enacting this section. And in fact, Representative Dellenbach said, ESA does not alter in any way the legal aspects of desegregation. Its purpose is to help school districts see that existing law is enforced. Senator Mondale, in discussing this, talked about Swan and said, the only actionable discrimination we have is de jure intentional segregation. HEW argues it's equally plausible that discrimination could mean disparate impact. And they allude to Title VII. They ignore, for one, the discussion here was desegregation and the cases that we were talking about with Swan and Brown. They ignore that Griggs had come down in March of 1971 and not one statement about Griggs, the Title VII case. They ignore that in the very section, 1605, D1, Discrimination is mentioned twice. They concede in subdivision D it's an intent test. Now they wish to ignore that.
Mr. Bruno, on that. Excuse me, go ahead.
Title VI was already on the books?
Oh, yes, 1964.
And was there some comparison with Title VI as to what the standard was?
In which are you talking about, HEW?
No, in the passage of this fact. This is.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I will get to that if you'd like.
Well, okay.
All right. Let me just go into the rationale for the demotions and dismissals test.
Before you go to that, Mr. Bruno, you've two or three times mentioned the language in subdivision D, but there they expressly use intent language in order to avoid. So that's not saying, it's not fair to infer that whenever they use the word discriminate, it had an intent test when they spelled it out in D.
Your Honor, they use the word discrimination. We think it's extremely important that they use that. Let me talk a bit about the language of subdivision
D. But wouldn't you agree in order to avoid is pretty clearly intent language?
Yes, we agree that that's an intent standard. We also feel that the B section is also. They rely essentially on the word otherwise. If you look at their brief, they rely on the use of the word otherwise to indicate that the test used for demotions and dismissals should be the same test used for staff assignments. And they say otherwise denotes commonality or similarity. They say it's obvious from using the word. Well, I just did very little research on that, and I looked at the dictionary. And the word otherwise does not mean commonality or similarity. It means in contrast. Now, it could mean that. And I would not say it could not mean that in the context of this statute. But I think if we look at how it was used here, and if we consider, if Congress wanted to say demotions and dismissals, the same test applied, disproportionate demotions and dismissals, and used the same test, all they had to say was disproportionate demotions, dismissals, assignment of staff, hiring, or promotion. They didn't do that. They broke this up. And the legislative history, which I'll get back to Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that's why I cite to Senate Committee Report 92-61, because I think that points out that they were talking about two separate clauses. The rationale for the disparate impact test for demotions and dismissals is very clear. HEW ignores what we say about this in their brief. Senate Committee Report 92-61 points out that Congress was concerned that districts at this time that had desegregation orders against them were demoting and dismissing black principals and staff in the South. And what Senator Mondale said during the ESA debates was that there had been wholesale firing of black teachers and principals in the South in conjunction with desegregation orders. So when they passed this section dealing with demotions and dismissals, they said disproportionate demotions and dismissals in conjunction with a desegregation order. So the rationale is very clear.
Your submission that just standing alone, the phrase practice discrimination implies intent.
The word discrimination, as was used there, we indicate
if it's unlawful to practice discrimination.
Yes.
Do you say that without reference to anything else in the statute that implies intentional?
In that statute, we believe it does. We believe it does.
Or just as a matter of the meaning of words.
Does the
practice of discrimination imply intent?
And I would say not in the meaning of words, but their juxtaposition in that statute, the way they use, when they wanted to talk about disproportionate, disparate impact test, they used the term disproportionate. They changed the term. They could very easily have kept that term to deal with the remaining elements. HEW would have us believe that all they were really doing there is saying disproportionate demotions and dismissals, and all the rest follow that test. For one, it doesn't read that way. And I say that's illogical. It's not what they were doing, because they used discrimination twice. HEW relies on another section, and so does the Court of Appeals, in finding that a disparate impact test applies to ESA eligibility. They rely on Section 1602A of the ESA statute. At the time that ESA was introduced, there was considerable discussion in Congress about doing something about de facto segregation. They wanted to do something, but they realized that the decisions of this court and elsewhere were prohibiting them from doing something about de facto segregation. So what they did is they passed ESA, and they said if you want ESA money, in order to be eligible, you must establish that you are implementing a court-ordered desegregation order, or you're going to do it voluntarily. What were they trying to do? They were trying to do away with de facto segregation by offering a carrot to districts they could not get at through the courts, but saying do away with de facto segregation and we will offer you this ESA funding. Section 1602A states, And so much is placed on this section, and so much discussion in ATW's brief and in the Court of Appeals. It states essentially, the guidelines and criteria of ESA be applied uniformly without regard to the origin or cause of the segregation. What that means is that ESA money be made available to districts regardless of whether it's de jure or de facto segregation. Go out and do something. It was broadening ESA eligibility. They would have us believe that 1602A meant a disparate impact test for ESA eligibility. Well, if it meant that, their concession that at least one element of ineligibility in subdivision D knocks that logic out totally. I would like now to get to the Title VI discussion. Perhaps we feel perhaps the most important and significant error in the opinion of the Court of Appeals was its failure to assess the impact of the Bakke decision on the standards of discrimination applicable under Title VI. The Court cited Bakke for its Title VII language, but as we said, I think, in our petition for cert, inexplicably, it said nothing about the Bakke case with respect to Title VI. Instead, they cited to Lau versus Nichols. The Court of Appeals relied on Title VI as an additional basis for finding that the disparate impact test applies to ESA eligibility. ATW has determined that Title VI is not an issue. I say it's a rather cavalier determination because in our petition for cert, perhaps our most important and perhaps our strongest point was the Court of Appeals failure to even note the Bakke decision in discussing Title VI. Title VI, whether it is the standard for ESA, or Title VI is the standard for establishing what is discrimination, we say, in this context. But whether it provides the actual standard for ESA eligibility or not, it's certainly interrelated. And let me explain why. The Court of Appeals said it was. The language says that it is. The statistics upon which the Court of Appeals, the HEW relied in finding the board ineligible was a Title VI noncompliance letter. Title VI is a major enforcement arm for all federal funding. ESA is incorporated through a series of amendments in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1964. Title VI enforces that act, and the procedural aspect of enforcement is codified in Title VI. Secretary Finch, during the ESA debate, said, when asked whether a district would be eligible for ESA funding if it was discriminating in the assignment of teachers, he stated that such a district would not be eligible because it would be violating Title VI. The Second Circuit, in a later decision cited in our main brief, the Parents Association of Andrew Jackson, has now said, well, I'll read it. We think that Title VI does not authorize federal judges to impose school desegregation remedies where there is no constitutional transgression. That is, where the racial imbalance is merely de facto. So now even the Second Circuit that issued this decision is wondering whether they did the right thing. They say the continued viability of Lau is suspect, and they're awaiting this court's consideration, perhaps in this case or in another case. The fact that the Second Circuit in their Jackson decision went into a bifurcated view of Title VI. It's in our brief, and I really don't think I should go over it in any great detail. But what it did is it went through such a tortured reasoning of Title VI to find that in this context, in this very case, that a disparate impact test could apply, and it likened it to Title VII, which it is not. It did that because it felt that Title VI was extremely relevant. The test was extremely relevant to what the test for ESA eligibility is. This is a desegregation case. Even under the Jackson decision of the circuit, we would fall within the intent test that they have indicated. The appropriate test, we say, for finding discriminatory intent was set out in the Arlington Heights case. ATW relied on two elements. They used a foreseeability test, citing to the Hart case of the Second Circuit, and on Swan they rely on some language in Swan. As this court has recently held in the Feeney case and in the Columbus Board of Education, foreseeability is one element in establishing intent. It is not in and of itself sufficient to establish intent. Secondly, I'd like to note that even the circuit, the Second Circuit in the Jackson case, has some doubts about the viability of the Hart case that it relied on. Lastly, I'd like to note that the Swan case, relied on by HEW in its finding of ineligibility for the Board of Education, cites this language: disparate racial composition of staff will establish a prima facie case of equal protection violation. Well, I say that's somewhat disingenuous to use that clause, because in Swan, we had a situation where we had de jure segregation. And yes, once you had a prior finding of de jure segregation, then you could use such a test to perhaps imply intent at a later time. Keyes makes that eminently clear. In New York City, we have no finding of intentional discrimination. Your Honor, I would like to ask the court to have an understanding of the ESA statute, that ESA was intended to make money available to districts that were experiencing de facto segregation. What else would it be for? It was to assist in doing that, in eliminating de facto segregation. HEW argues in their brief, the solution adopted in ESA was to employ the carrot approach to encourage the voluntary elimination, reduction, or prevention of minority group isolation. Then they continue, it seems evident that with such a starting point, it would make no sense to grant funds to school districts that, although not violating the Constitution, were maintaining a segregated system. The logic is incredible to me. That's what it's all about. I thought the money was to be made available to districts that had de facto segregation. That's what the intent is all about. They would deny it to the very districts that have the type of segregation that this money is intended to work on. We have an extensive program in New York. We're ready to go ahead with that program. HEW has taken the course that we are not eligible here. We are not eligible in the following year. I say that what they are doing is frustrating the legislative purpose, the clear intent of the legislature. Their brief doesn't deal with this. Their brief deals with virtually nothing with respect to the legislative history. It talks a bit about 1602. It cites no cases except for the Aspira case. And I think they think that if in fact, they think it's all right and they want to interpret the legislative intent their way, that's sufficient. I think they have to look a little more closely to what Congress intended.
What do you do with this statement with 1602B when you're making your Title VI argument?
Well, 1602...
Where it says that the policies, the guidelines and criteria under Title VI shall apply evenly throughout the country regardless of the... whether it's de jure or de facto.
Right. That's the Stennis Amendment. That's part of... We have an argument in our brief regards to the Stennis Amendment. Senator Stennis put an amendment on the floor of Congress, which was later adopted and became Section 1602A and 1602B. What Senator Stennis was attempting to do was to make a policy statement to perhaps the nation, to perhaps the Congress, perhaps this Court. He wanted to see something done about de facto segregation. He was saying, essentially, that the South was being burdened.
Well, if he was saying in Title VI, if Congress was saying that from here on, here is what Title VI would mean.
I don't think
if
they were
Congress
saying that.
Was saying that.
I don't think they were saying that.
It would five people, at least five people in Baki were a little off base.
I understand that, but what he was saying was, this is simply a policy statement. I think it's very clear from his own language. He said, why should not Congress light one little lamp?
Well, but he said it, but this is Congress, this is in the act.
I understand.
It isn't just Senator Stennis. This was adopted by both houses of Congress.
I understand that.
By the President.
I think it's no more than a policy statement. And I don't believe it had any other actionability. I don't believe that Congress intended it to do anything other. And you have to look at the legislative history to get that. And you get it very clear from the discussions of Senator Javits.
Well, the holding, you say the holding in Bakke is just to the contrary of this.
Yes.
About Title VI.
Yes. And I say that that portion of the ESA statute is no more than a policy statement, as is Section 1602A. If 1602A means anything, it means to broaden ESA eligibility. In the end, I would ask this court...
Well, you mean to, when you say to broaden ESA eligibility, you mean to broaden it not only to cases where there were de facto segregation, but where there was de jure segregation.
Oh, yes. Actually, the other way, I would say it. Clearly for de jure, but certainly to broaden it to do something about de facto segregation. I think that was the clear intent of Congress. I don't think there could have been any other intent.
Well, then why would Senator Stennis be putting it in?
Well, Senator Stennis, his remarks are very clear. He was attempting to light one little candle. He wanted to go on the record. To be honest, I think he wanted to go on the record in an enactment of Congress to say something about doing something about de facto segregation.
But you would think that a senator coming from a state where there had been a history of segregation by law and clearly de jure segregation would be urging that schools guilty of de jure segregation be eligible for this aid, not only schools guilty of de facto segregation.
Well, you see, when he initially submitted the Stennis Amendment, he included ESA, Title VI, and Section 182 together. I think he was attempting to sensitize the Congress, the nation, I'd say this court, to do something in the future about de facto segregation. I think he was clearly... I can't read that. I think he was clearly just attempting to make a policy statement. I do not know what else he could have been attempting to do. I think he may have also been trying to frustrate, the way he presented it, I think he was trying to frustrate the use of Title VI because he realized what the law was, and what he was attempting to do was to put Title VI in the same box with ESA. ESA could be used against de facto and de jure segregation. As he presented it, it included ESA, Title VI, and Section 182 all together. They use the same language. Congress, in the conference committee, broke that out. I think they broke it out because clearly ESA could be used against de facto and de jure, but Title VI could not. Your Honor, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
Mr. Solicitor General.
May it please the Court, we understand that petitioners do not contest the substantial disproportions in the assignment of full-time minority teachers. Further, they do not deny that the schools were statistically racially identifiable as a result of the disparities in staff assignments. They argue that the statute and regulations must be construed to require the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to establish that the disparities resulted from purposeful or intentional discrimination in the constitutional sense. Although on remand, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare found that petitioners' teacher assignment policies were unconstitutional, and the district court affirmed, we do not have to decide, we submit, whether the administrative record supports that finding, because the Court of Appeals expressly declined to address that question. Also, we need not decide whether the Court of Appeals dictum about the sufficiency of an objective test for a violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is present. The regulation, 45 Code of Federal Regulations, 185.43,
Mr. General, what if we disagreed with you or agreed with the submission of your friend here that this statute incorporates the constitutional test?
Well, we submit that it does not incorporate the constitutional test for the reasons that...
What if we agreed with him?
Well, I think if this Court agrees with him, then its course would be to remand this to allow the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit to address the question of whether there is a constitutional violation shown on the administrative record. And we think it does, but we don't propose to argue it here.
I'll put it this way. What if we agreed with you? Is there any claim in this case that, as construed, to cover merely impact, this particular statute is unconstitutional? Because
we don't understand petitioner to make that contention.
Does this statute rest on the spending power, or does it commerce, or 14th Amendment, or does anybody know?
Well, I think it rests certainly on the spending power. It might rest on the implementation of the 14th Amendment, but I don't think we need to decide that either.
Well, if it did, it's running against the state, and then you may have a problem on the Constitution.
There might be a problem there. I would like to suggest if the Congress, for example, thought that it would be good to promote a foreign language instruction in public schools, it could appropriate special funds for the purpose of encouraging public schools to inaugurate or strengthen existing or foreign language programs, and it could provide for certain qualifications and for certain disqualifying features. For example, it might say that a teacher to whom the language to be taught is not a native tongue may not participate in this program. And I suppose then we would just look to see whether the statute was followed in a particular case and whether the regulations promulgated to enforce it were authorized by the statute. And I think that's exactly what we have here.
General McCree, in your hypothesis, Congress is not directing the state or the school to have foreign language instruction. They're simply offering financial aid if the state chooses to have it.
Well, as we see this, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, the Congress is not directing the states to participate in this program. As my brother, Mr. Bruno, has suggested, this is a carrot on the stick. If the state wishes to do so, it may do so. But if it does, it may not be disqualified as provided for in 1605D, as we urge. The regulation clearly makes the school board ineligible if it has assigned its teachers, quote, in such a manner as to identify any of such schools as intended for students of a particular race, color, or national origin. We do not understand petitioners to challenge at all the determination that these schools are so identifiable. So we're right at the statute. We submit that the Congress showed that it knew how to require unconstitutional or purposeful discrimination when it wanted to. And we refer to Section 1605D, where in response to a question from the court, my brother sought to make the point that discrimination there was purposeful. And indeed it is, because it says, in order to avoid the participation of minority group children.
We'll recess until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Thank you.